Okay, well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. I've forgotten about the cancer thing, actually, but I can probably wind my way into that as I speak. I do have a broad idea of some things I might talk to you about this morning, but I like to wing it when I'm speaking these days and see who turns up, who I'm speaking to, before I decide precisely what I might say. But one thing I'd like to say simply because you refer to it when you were introducing me, my boldness and frankness, as it were, this is a quality which many people acknowledge and which has got me into trouble many, many times in the course of my life. But actually, it's a family trait. I come from Middlesbrough. Most people don't even know where Middlesbrough is, but it's in the northeast of England. It's off the sort of main east coast train route. And the train stops at Darlington, not at Middlesbrough. Nobody ever wants to go to Middlesbrough. It's like a branch line. Actually, Middlesbrough's got big problems. It's seriously depopulated at the moment. But there's no work. But I was born and raised up there just after the Second World War. Anyway, the people of Middlesbrough, certainly my family, were always pretty frank about everything. And I remember I went to see a cousin of mine. I'd not seen her for years. Maybe 15 or so years, and I can't even remember why I met up with her on this particular occasion, but I went to see her when she was living in Liverpool. And the first thing I said to her was, long time no see. And she immediately, and her response was, well, that was your fault, wasn't it? I mean, I just disappeared basically from my family for about 15 years, but from their point of view, but that's the sort of atmosphere that I was raised in. I've always been, you know, that kind of frankness, that kind of boldness, if you like, has been part of my my conditioning. Very difficult to sort of hold it back sometimes. I tend to say what I think, which is not a bad thing in many ways, because it means that people know, they know that what you see is what you get, which actually means that they can trust you. So it's quite a useful quality, I suppose, to have, even though it's got me into a lot of trouble. And on the basis of that, I've developed quite a fearsome reputation in some quarters. Anyway, that's just a little bit of my past history. What I thought I'd talk about this morning might connect with this in some way. See, let's just wait and see. I wanted to talk in a general kind of way about the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, and how we go about practicing that in this particular culture at this particular time. If I look back over my life, I can see, well, there's been some quite remarkable cultural changes, been quite some remarkable shifts in attitude. Some of them for the better, some of them very much, as far as I'm concerned, for the worse. But whatever's going on in the wider society, the society in which we live at any particular time, they influence us. And they, well, the sort of attitudes of the wider society to some extent impose upon us. They sort of gradually eat their way in. And if you're trying to practice the Dharma, you've got to try to become aware of this. Try to keep the sort of views which may not necessarily be in harmony with the Dharma at bay. But it's not an easy thing to do. The poet Shelley, on one occasion, spoke about the world's slow stain. And what he meant by that was that no matter how idealistic you might be, let's say, how much you try to lead an inspired and a good life, the attitudes of the world slowly seep into you. And they're a stain. It's the world's slow stain. These things affect us slowly, gradually. We barely notice that it's happening. But they come into us, they seep into us, and they leave a stain. They leave their mark. And it's very, very difficult to sort of remove that stain. I mean, stain isn't dirt. It's something which has gone really deeply into the fibre of something. And so this is what happens to us. We are affected by the world's slow stem. And one of the things which has struck me, well, time and again, really, over the last 20, even 30 years, is the extent to which nowadays, it seems to me at least, that we live in a culture where we're almost encouraged to blame. We're encouraged to blame other people for our bad experiences in life. We don't really want to take responsibility for our bad experiences in life. If we can blame somebody else, that lets us off the hook. So that kind of attitude is very, very deeply ingrained, it seems to me, in our present society. And I think it's something that we need to become more and more and more aware of. I think it's something that we have to try to resist, because it's one of these things which will sort of slowly undermine whatever emotional positivity that we develop. So that's partly my starting point, really. How to deal with that? There's a whole sort of series of connected issues there. I remember, for example, some years ago, probably about 15 years ago now, waking up one morning in my community feeling grumpy. And this, I mean, this is not characteristic of me, but I felt grumpy. And I didn't know why I felt grumpy. And I thought quite a bit about it. And I realised, well, I'm getting old. You know, and the older you get, the more prone you become to complain. You know, anything goes wrong, we start to complain. And it seemed to me that if I was not careful, I was going to start falling victim to that. That I'd start to become a grumpy old man. And I really didn't want to become a grumpy old man. I'd rather be dead, frankly. From a spiritual point of view, if you become a grumpy old man, old woman, then you're dead anyway. So why not just why not do something about that? So I decided that I needed to address this. And I didn't quite know what the best answer to it was, but I found the answer pretty quickly to sort of, you know, get rid of this emerging grumpiness and tendency to complain. And the answer is quite simple, really. Well, there are a number of answers, but the answer for me was that I was asked to go back to India. I've spent a lot of time in India over the years in my capacity as overall mitra convener. I used to go there every year and meet up with the mitras there, take study for them, give talks and so on and so forth. But I hadn't been for a year or two because I'd ceased to be overall mitra convener. There no longer is such a function anymore. But anyway, I was asked, it was suggested that I go to Nagaloka in Nagpur, where we have a kind of, it's almost like a college campus, where we conduct courses in the Dharma for young Dalits. They're year-long courses. And so I went along there, not quite knowing what to expect, but the age of the students was between 17 and 22. Most of them were between 17 and 22. And they were so bright, they were so vibrant, so full of energy. It had a sort of, my contact with them had a sort of revitalizing effect upon me in a number of different ways. And I felt a certain lightness that I remembered from when I was much younger myself, but which had been absent from my life for a number of years. And it was then that I realized what I need as I get older is contact with younger people. That's not always easy to get when you get older, because quite often younger people are not always that keen to spend time with older people. But if you've got something to offer them, then they're quite keen. And at Nagaloka, I found that I did have something to offer them. I was teaching every day. It was a pretty rigorous program. We're teaching. I taught a class for 3 hours every morning. I was there. Well, actually, not absolutely every morning, but most mornings I did, as well as teaching in the evening. And it was a three-hour session with about 60 students, none of whom, of course, understood any English. I had to work through a translator. But we managed somehow to communicate, and I managed to develop a relationship with them. I managed to communicate with them, and they stimulated me. They gave me tremendous stimulus. And of course, they're also deeply, deeply appreciative of what they were receiving from me. And so it was something which was, I was able to benefit them, they were able to benefit me. And I came to the conclusion that, at least as far as I'm concerned, I need to have contact with younger people. Because I need that. I think older people need younger people. I think we need it, because otherwise, if we just spend our time with our, you know, with people of our own age, once you reach a certain let's say maturity, the tendency is to go rather dull and to settle down. But this really, really had a thoroughly energizing effect upon me. The other conclusion I came to was that young people need old people. But it depends on the older person, not any old person. I think if you led a decent life, not seriously, if you led a good life, if you've got something to offer young people, they'll want to be with you, because you've got experience that they need, that they can learn from. And when they see that, they'll come to you. And that was very much my experience at Nagaloka over the years that I was going there. Unfortunately, I'm not able to go there at the moment, because just over a year ago I was diagnosed with cancer, as quite a few of you probably already know that, because of what Vijay Shree has said, but that sort of made it impossible for me to go just at that time. I may eventually go back, I certainly hope I can, assuming I live. That's a whole other story. But at the moment my cancer is in remission, so with a bit of luck I'll get a few more years of life ahead of me, and I'd be able to go back to India. I would very much like to do that. But yes, so that's one of the solutions, I think, to grumpiness. Should you find yourself becoming grumpy? Should you find yourself becoming dull? If you find that you're settling down, one of the reasons why I think people get grumpy, and this is something I thought a lot about, because it wasn't just me that was getting grumpy. I was living in a men's community. And I love men's communities. I've lived in men's communities all my life. But this community, the age in this community was gradually going up. And there was a certain amount of grumpiness sort of naturally creeping into our communication with each other, which wasn't good. And so it was what I felt I needed to... I knew I needed to get out of that somehow. Fortunately, I was kicked out, so... We're not quiet. That's not there. Maja Maloka, where I was living at that time, was sold eventually, partly to buy the property, which is now Adishtana. And I wasn't going to be included in the community there, so I was sort of temporarily homeless. I was homeless for about 3 years, I think. But anyway, I dealt with that. But when I left Maja Maloka, it was really quite a remarkable experience, because the moment I walked out the door, I suddenly felt invigorated. I felt that I'd left shed a huge burden. What I think I'd actually shed was my settled downness, because I felt as if I was going forth again. And you may be familiar with this expression of going forth. And going forth isn't something you do once. It's something we have to do again and again and again and again. And what we're going forth from are our habits. Our bad habits, of which we have many, grumpiness being just one example. And so we have to learn to keep on going forth. And I think for a while, I'd sort of forgotten that. I mean, of course, I knew theoretically that I needed to do it, but somehow the circumstances of my life were making me go forth again. And as I walked out of Maja Maloka for the last time, walking up the street with one of my young friends, Vijay Ruchi, who was there at that time, he's quite young there, relatively young there, I just felt overcome by a sense of joy. And I didn't understand why. At the time, I realised afterwards, it's because I'm going forth again. So I think that, and also I really didn't know where I was going to be in a few months' time. I'd been invited to go to Melbourne and do some teaching down there from my friends there. I used to be the president of the Melbourne Buddhist Centre, And so I was happy to go and do that. But after that, my life was very, very uncertain. Eventually, they took me in out of compassion. The OBC, one of the most communities there, where I've been for the last 3 years. But I think the tendency, when we get older, is to settle down. We want things to remain stable. We don't want things to change. And that is something, if you want to remain spiritually vital, you must resist. And you can start resisting it in small ways. For example, if you find that you're becoming a little bit grumpy, you're complaining more than you do, more than you used to, where to stop? A young Chinese woman was talking to me in one class recently. She wanted some advice from me. She's from mainland China. We get quite a few Chinese coming on the LBC at the moment. And she said, give me some advice, David Mitchell. What can I do? I want to change my life. And we talked a bit and talked about her recent experience. I said, well, one thing you can do is just stop complaining. Not that she's complaining badly, but I said, look, if you want to remain young, the thing to do is stop complaining. Don't complain. In fact, why not take that as a discipline? Just don't complain about anything. And she thought about it. She said, well, I'll give it a try. And so she came back and talked to me at the class a week later. She said, it really works, doesn't it? If you don't complain, you feel so much better. I said, well, yes, you know. I mean, can you remember a single time when you complain made you feel better? Even if you get what you want as a result of complaining, does it make you feel better? He said, no. It's much better not to complain. So that's one thing. If you want to remain in contact with that kind of youthful spirit, well, stop complaining. Sure, maybe you don't complain. I leave that to you. I'm not accusing anybody. But if you do find yourself tempted to complain about anything, resist it. It's such a bad habit to get into. And of course, that links in with the whole issue of blaming. Now, one of the reasons we do this, it seems to me, is that we don't really take proper responsibility for our lives. We don't really take proper responsibility for who we are or for our mental states. But this is absolutely fundamental to Buddhism. If you want to lead the Buddhist life, the first thing you have to do is to learn to take responsibility, first of all, for your own actions, but of course also, if this is implied, for the mental states of which they are an expression, whether these be actions of body, speech, or mind. So this is absolutely fundamental. You want to lead the Buddhist life, learn to take responsibility, deeper responsibility, fuller responsibility, greater responsibility for your mental states. It really does come back to that. When I'm teaching meditation these days, I tend to speak of it. In fact, I'm speaking it more and more in terms of taking responsibility for your mental states. Because as you must be aware, every time you sit down to meditate, what's there? Your mind. It's your mind. It's not anybody else's mind. And what you're feeling, or what you're thinking, what's passing through your mind, belongs to you, not to anybody else. It's you. It's that, if you like, that you have to take responsibility for. So if you have bad experiences, and we all have bad experiences, I've had many, many bad experiences in my life. I feel ultimately that I must take responsibility for that. The Buddha says, somewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya, I think, that we are heirs to our own actions. We are heirs to, well, yes, in other words, our own actions determine our experience. Not absolutely everything, of course, otherwise that would imply that there's no other factors at work other than karma, and I'm not saying that, but, you know, we are heirs to our own actions. And the sort of what we experience will be rooted very much in that. So that's another reason, really, not to complain. To say just stop complaining, perhaps not the most useful thing to do. We need something more than that. We need something to sort of move us to do that, move as well to, to sort of balance that. And it occurs to me that, well, the opposite of complaining is expressing appreciation. After all, there's so many things for which, well, we have cause to be grateful. Again, I'm not saying you should be grateful, but if you can think of things for which you appreciate, it quite naturally sort of gives rise to gratitude. At least that's what I find. And if you feel gratitude, well, you want to express that, at least verbally, if not in some other way. And if you can, if you feel appreciation and gratitude, that quite naturally leads to generosity. But coming back specifically to gratitude, I find myself again in recent times speaking so much about this because I think it's the perfect antidote to whatever tendency you might have to complain or to blame. Just think of things that for which we all really perhaps should be, well, I mean, I don't like to use the word should, but it would be the healthy response would be one of gratitude. For example, we take so much for granted in our society. So many things run, well, this our society runs very, very smoothly. It's a very, very free society. It's probably the freest society there's ever been in the history of the planet. And yet people complain about it. Feel that they're not getting a good deal from life or whatever. But there's so much to appreciate. So many services that we take for granted. I mean, for example, our water is pure. Relatively speaking, it's got a lot of chlorine in it, but it's pure. It's not going to. We're not going to get giardia or typhoid or cholera. We have clean water. Many people in the world don't. And who provides that clean water? Well, the people who work for the water companies, of course, but also a significant part of that is those who work in the sewage industry. People who keep those basic services running. We don't even think about those things. Water is literally on tap. We have so many things that are on tap. So if you can't think of anything else, well, you can think of things like that. Well, at least I can appreciate that I have the benefit of these things. I can appreciate and feel grateful for those. But I think looking for things for which you can feel gratitude is a very positive antidote, a very good antidote to the any tendency that we have to complain, to moan, it's even worse, or sort of blame others for our bad experience in life. Don't, in other words, it's not the most helpful thing usually to sort of dwell upon why we have bad experience. Move yourself away from that. Move towards appreciation and expression of gratitude. It seems to me that gratitude is one of the most beautiful of all human emotions. It's certainly just to experience gratitude is wonderful. Just to experience it, to express it, is even better. And when gratitude is well received, that's even better still. When you express gratitude, it could be for something quite small, or it could be something quite major. But when you express gratitude, and that is well received by somebody else, well, it's like you begin to go up the spiral. So gratitude is gratitude and appreciation are the roots out, or one of the roots out of our tendency to complain or anything of that sort. But fundamentally, what we have to do, well, the first thing we have to do is take responsibility for our mental states. Take responsibility for our actions, take responsibility for our lives, take responsibility for who we are. And out of that, look for things that we can find that we appreciate and give expression to our appreciation, to our gratitude, whatever. So if you like, there's a sort of process of becoming aware, more aware of what's going on in our own lives, of what's going on in our own lives, the development of positive emotion. And then when you've got that kind of base, what then happens is it will change the whole character of your experience of life. So that the bad things in life are not quite so bad. I think one of the things that I learned fairly early on when I got involved in what used to be the FWBL, which is now, of course, true right now, was to make the most of the painful experiences that came to me in my life. Make the most of adversity. Traditionally, of course, adversity is spoken of as an opportunity. We all have bad experiences. We all have painful experiences, sometimes very, very painful experiences. But they represent an opportunity. They're a wake-up call in a way, whatever those experiences might be. But we first of all, of course, have to let them in. Let them in and then use them. And I've done this a number of times in my life. Here's one example. There are many, many examples I could give, but in 1981, I was at the LBC for the first time. Well, I moved to the LBC at the beginning of 1980. Before that, I'd served a centre in Norwich. But I moved to the LBC in 1980. I'd been asked to go there. It was just after the centre had opened. And I was there for about 20 months. And, it didn't go well. I seemed to upset rather a lot of people in a very short space of time. As a consequence, they weren't too keen for me to remain there. Of course, they couldn't throw me out, but not really. But on the other hand, it was quite clear that they would prefer that I wasn't there, so I left eventually. And that was a deeply humiliating experience for me. I hadn't behaved particularly well. No, I hadn't done anything serious, very, very, very bad or anything, but it was just, I'd been a bit insensitive, I hadn't expressed anything, I hadn't been acting out of ill will or anything of that sort, but I'd been a little bit very unaware and insensitive towards others sometimes. And anyway, in the end, I had to leave. Nobody said that to me, but I knew, and I did. And I learned from it. It was a very painful experience, but I knew I had to learn from it. I'd made mistakes. We all make mistakes. To make mistakes is only, after all, human. None of us are perfect. But it's important to learn from the mistakes that we make in life. And I tried to do that. And I believe that I did. But then again, there are other experiences in life which are painful, which come to us, we're not necessarily directly responsible for. It's just the conditions of the samsara, the conditions in which we live. Part of the deal, if you like, you get a body where you get certain unpleasant experiences. I remember on one occasion, not that long ago, I was at Navaloka. It was the last time I was there. And in many ways, that was the most difficult visit I'd ever had to India. It was also the most rewarding, oddly enough. These things quite often go hand in glove. And I'd been at Navaloka for a few months, and I had a growth on my arm which was bleeding, wouldn't stop bleeding. Eventually, of course, it needed to be removed because it was spreading. And it was a basal cell carcinoma. My first encounter with cancer, a benign cancer, not a life-threatening one, but I had to go to Pune to get it removed surgically. It had to be removed twice, as it happened. Anyway, I had to come. Well, I'd been staying in Pune for 2 weeks. I had a break from Navaloka, and Navaloka is not the most salubrious place. It's pretty basic accommodation. I was fortunate enough to have a room to myself, it was an ensuite room, Indian style bathroom and toilet. Anyway, without going to all that, I was away for 2 weeks in Pune, staying with an order member who was a doctor who supervised my treatment while I was there. And he's got a very nice house in Pune. He's very, very comfortable. And I was seduced back into the sort of comforts, not quite Western style, but not far off it, into a very comfortable environment. And then, of course, I had to return to Navaloka once the stitches had been taken out of my arm, after this carcinoma had been removed. And I went back to Navaloka, and I arrived late in the evening, and this is tricky because the following morning I was holding a seminar for the ordinary members in Nagaloka, at Nagaloka. So I had a full day ahead of me. I got back to Nagaloka about 10 o'clock at night, and I went to my room, and the moment I opened the door, I knew there was something seriously wrong. The stench hit me straight away. And what had happened while I'd been away, I had very foolishly left the door open to this sort of bathroom. And the rats had found their way up underneath the sort of the place where the water drains down the floor. And I don't know how many rats had been in my room, but boy, it stank to high heaven. And they'd eaten everything I'd left out, including my paracetamol. I won't say any more. There was rat poo all over the entire room, my bedding, everything. And I knew that I couldn't stay in that room that night. And my initial response, well, you can imagine, just imagine yourself in that situation. How would you respond? You wouldn't be pleased, would you? And I wasn't pleased. Boy, I wasn't pleased. And I was about to curse the rats in my mind, I think, no! And I just caught myself in time, and I didn't. I paused, and I just didn't allow myself to curse, basically. I knew I needed to get a new room, another room. I had to sort it out quickly. We got it sorted. I stayed in another room that night. But anyway, when everything was sorted and everything settled down, and I was reflecting upon it, I realized that part of my reaction was the fact that I'd become soft again during those 2 weeks. You know, I'd been softened up, and the sort of less salubrious environment of Nagaloka suddenly hit me hard, and the rats, of course, didn't help. But I started laughing because I thought, well, the rats are my kalyanamitra. They brought me back to reality. It's not the reality I wanted to be brought back to, but it was reality. It was the reality of my immediate experience. And I actually felt grateful to the rats. And when I was speaking about I couldn't help but mention this the following morning when I was leading this seminar with the order members. I said, those rats were my kalyanamitra. Of course they all laughed. They like that idea, but anyway, that's the sort of thing you have to learn to do, is to make the most of your bad experiences in life, of whatever kind they are. And there are far worse experiences than having your room full of rat poo and all the rest of it. There really are. Get things into perspective. This is something, again, that we find very, very difficult to do. When something unpleasant happens to us, something painful, it's very, very difficult to get it into perspective, bring things into the wider perspective. And I think it's something we have to gradually learn to do. And there's always further you can go with it. And I found this very much to be the case when I was diagnosed with cancer. I knew at once when my GP told me, well, she told me I had, she's referring me for suspected prostate cancer, but I knew at once it was serious. I could tell by the expression on her face, suddenly she started to talk to me in a different kind of way. It's like I was dealing with a different person somehow. It's almost as if there was a distance opening up between us, and it had nothing to do with me. It was almost like she was instinctively, doctor though she was, trying to distance herself from me, which is quite a curious thing, quite a curious experience. She said there's a large hard abnormality on my prostate. So I presume that, and of course that turned out to be large aggressive cancer, large aggressive tumour. But I knew immediately the significance of that, even though it was just as we inferred for suspected prostate cancer. She clearly had no doubts, and indeed she was correct. But my response to that was, okay, how are you going to deal with this? And I went for a walk around Victoria Park, which is very close to the LBC. And I just pondered that question, how are you going to deal with this? It's important you deal with it positively. I actually felt very, very calm about it. It didn't actually trouble me, oddly enough. I thought that it would have done. I mean, before, if someone had asked me the week before, if you told, you know, that you've got a suspected prostate cancer, how do you think you'd respond? And I'm sure I said, well, I would respond with fear and anxiety, but I didn't. And it just was suddenly, what I think happened was that I was confronted by the reality of life in a deeper way. You know, death comes to all of us. Old age comes to all of us, assuming we live long enough. Sickness comes to all of us. This is, after all the Buddha taught us. You know, what started his spiritual quest was seeing sickness, old age, and death, really seeing them. And so when you're confronted with a life-threatening disease like that, it really does bring that much, much closer to you. And I couldn't get away from it. It was reality for me. It wasn't just a theory, it was a reality. I had a life-threatening disease, which fortunately at the moment is in remission, but it may not stay in remission. And it may eventually kill me. And that's, I mean, I feel quite okay about that. But the reason partly for that is that it opens up a different perspective. I remember I met a woman, I was so weak from radiotherapy, having also been through chemotherapy earlier. I could hardly walk for a while, I was in a wheelchair for 5 weeks when I was going through radiotherapy. And so I had to go to the hospital to complete my radiotherapy course by ambulance. And on one occasion, I was talking with a woman of about my age. She'd been an actress, actually, like that. It's just a coincidence, because I was an actor when I was younger. And we got talking, and she could hardly walk because she just had a large secondary tumour removed out of her thigh. Anyway, we just talked about life, really, and she just looked at me and said in a very, very calm kind of way, she said, you know, when you get something like this, it really changes the way you see things, doesn't it? And it does. I can tell you from experience, but there was someone who wasn't a Buddhist, just responding very, very positively to her cancer. But in her case, it was terminal. I mean, she had a large secondary tumour removed from her thigh. She had secondary, metastatic lung cancer. So the cancer had spread to other parts of her body, and she didn't have very much longer to live. But anyway, the last thing she said to me, I met her once or twice, was, well, till the next time, if there is a next time, you never know with this thing, do you? And actually, which is so positive, I was really, really not just impressed, I was moved. And her condition was far more serious than my own. But anyway, the point about this is that when you come up against the reality of life in that kind of way, and it doesn't have to be a terminal illness which brings about this sort of experience. There are all sorts of other experiences that can bring this about. It really does shift your perspective on things. And one of the things that I regret now, at this stage in my life, having gone through my hardcore cancer treatments and sort of recovering from the treatments, and it's quite a thing recovering from the treatments, let alone the disease, but I feel that I've lost something. You know, when I was going through those treatments, not quite being sure what their outcome might be, whether the treatments would work or not, I felt like I was living on the edge most of the time. You know, I felt that, you know, reality was like right there. Not all the time, because even then I'd forget But I try not to forget. I try to keep that reality before me. But it's so, so difficult to do that. But I wanted to keep that reality there because it keeps this broader perspective open. And that means that your experience of life is so much more enriched in a way. Life becomes so much more vivid when you realise just how fragile it is. And actually, what happens when you have a terminal illness? Of course, that brings that very much to the fore. But we're all in the same boat. It's so easy to forget that. But the fact is that life itself is a terminal disease. It ends in death, doesn't it? Well, that's what a terminal disease ends in, death. Well, life ends in death. We don't live forever. We can't. None of us can live forever. So we're all in the same boat, really. It's just that in the case of someone with a terminal illness, it's right there before them. Unfortunately, not everybody with terminal illness deals with it that positively. It's easy for someone like me because I've got a dharmic perspective to bring to it. And I've noticed time and again, many of my fellow order members who've had terminal illnesses, they've responded so positively. I can't think of many who've not. I'm not sure I can think of any. There might be some, I don't know. But I can think of two people who've died of cancer recently. And they've faced it full on, with a very, very positive spirit. It's not quite what you would expect of human beings when they're, when they're confronted by that sort of thing. But sometimes, you see, adversity of whatsoever kind brings out the best in us. And that's another reason to value it. It can stimulate you into a kind of, a higher state of being almost. Very difficult to sustain. But nonetheless, it gives you glimpses of things. Glimpses, I suppose, of what our ultimate goal is. I was, a couple of weeks ago, I went to a concert at the Wigmore Hall, because Imogen, what's her second name? Very famous British pianist. Something got out of my mind. Imogen Cooper. Imogen Cooper was playing. So I went to a concert, she was playing Haydn and Beethoven, I think, mostly. And anyway, I really enjoyed the concert, but a few days later, a friend of mine sent me a link to a lecture that she'd given in Oxford a few years back, which he thought I'd enjoy, and which he'd found quite inspiring. So I watched this on YouTube a few days back. And she's just basically talking about her life as a performer and what that meant to her and why she did it and the kind of life that was for her. One of the things that most struck me was that she said that, well, of course, many people think that, well, how glamorous to live a life as a performer, especially as a highly regarded performer, as she is. She didn't describe herself in those terms. She wouldn't have done that, of course, but she is a very fine pianist. Anyway, she said, well, of course, why do you do it? We do it because of those wonderful moments. Usually that happen in performance, but transcendence. And the way she spoke about transcendence, she certainly is speaking of the experience of an elevated state of consciousness. That was quite clear. What she might understand by that in a deeper way, I don't know, but there was certainly something which resonated with me. But what really interested me was that she said, well, so people might think that to be a concert pianist, to travel the world, and so forth, playing in Carnegie Hall, Royal Festival Hall, wherever it happens to be, is a very glamorous thing to do. But she said, there's no very little glamour in it, which didn't surprise me to hear her say that. She said, just think of the reality. She said, you're constantly moving around. You're constantly living hotels, noisy hotels. You can't properly sleep at night because of the noise in the hotel, for example. Just think of the stresses that puts your intimate relations under. And I mean, which way she spoke about it, I mean, suggested to that, you know, maybe it had been very, very difficult for her to have any kind of meaningful relationship with her partners or whatever. I don't know what her marital or non-marital status is, but she knew the stresses of that life. She had endured the stresses of that life because those moments of transcendence were clearly the most important thing in her life. And she was speaking about this not in a selfish kind of way, because she understood as well that you know, it's not something that she does, it's something which comes about because of conditions. And part of the necessary conditions are the audience, because music is like a communication from the performer to the audience, and it's a two-way process. And when I was an actor, I used to say, I realised, it seemed to me, that, well, I used to say a little arrogantly, that audiences got the performances they deserved. And what I meant by that is that you can do your best as a performer, but unless the audience responds, the whole thing's going to go flat. And she sort of said something, she didn't use my arrogant language, but she said something kind of similar. And I could immediately sort of understand what she was talking about. But I suppose why I'm saying this is that for anything which is of true value in life, it comes at a price. Whether it's a Dharma life, whether it's a career, there's a kind of downside to it. There's the hard work. There's the adversity that comes with that. And we have to learn to endure it, just as she, as a concert pianist, had to endure the lifestyle for those moments that she valued so highly. So, anyway, that's maybe enough for this morning. Mm-hmm.